This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the first week of June, and this week the president was in Europe. He visited Normandy and honored American veterans on the 75th anniversary of the Allied invasion that began the end of Nazi domination of Western Europe. To the men that sit behind me and to the boys that rest in the field before me, your example will never grow old, the president declared. He also found time to criticize domestic opponents, saying in Normandy that Robert Mueller had made a fool of himself and that Nancy Pelosi was, quote, a nasty, vindictive, horrible person, unquote. That came after Pelosi reportedly told Democratic colleagues behind closed doors that she doesn't want to see the president impeached. She wants to see him imprisoned after a trial after he's voted out of office. Lock him up, I guess. But in addition to France, the president visited the United Kingdom, getting his long-awaited state visit at a time of great turbulence in that country. The UK is still stumbling toward a resolution on Brexit, but with no agreement in sight and Prime Minister Theresa May on her way out, what does the future hold for Britain's relationship with both Europe and the United States? Later in the show, Amanda Sloat from the Brookings Center on the United States and Europe will join us to discuss that. We'll also look at some policy proposals from Cory Booker and Kamala Harris to deal with the housing affordability crisis. Can the federal government help put housing in more people's reach? But now let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center, and I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right, and on the left, Elizabeth Brunig of The Washington Post. Hello.
Hi, Josh.
Hey, Josh.
So, Rich, what have you been watching this week?
Well, we talked about this last week, but there have been developments in the impending tariff fight with Mexico. There appear to be actually serious negotiations going on in Washington, and Mexico has sent 6,000 troops to its southern border and is discussing asylum changes. And one thing, at least on the table, is Mexico agreeing to be a safe third country, which would mean asylum seekers from the Northern Triangle would have to apply in Mexico. And if they didn't and came here, we could just reject them. This would be an enormous change. It'd be a tremendous political and substantive victory for Trump, but it seems very unlikely that the Mexicans are going to really agree to that. I would expect something much short of that. And meantime, it's emerged that U.S. Republican senators are almost wholly opposed to Trump's policy. I wouldn't expect to see action soon while these negotiations are ongoing. But if Trump actually goes through with the tariffs and they begin to escalate, we could see a genuine revolt on Capitol Hill, the likes of which we haven't seen against this president from his own party yet.
Liz, a lot of the discussion around the Trump administration's desire for this so-called safe third country agreement, where Mexico would agree that people passing through Mexico seeking asylum would have to seek it there rather than in the U.S., has focused around the apparent impossibility of it, that Mexico is not likely to agree to it, that it is a red line for Mexican President López Obrador. In the event that Trump actually succeeds in getting concessions from Mexico on that, is that something that progressives in the United States should oppose or should welcome?
I mean, it's hard to say. I think we haven't really seen very clear delineation of what this kind of plan would mean for the refugees themselves or people fleeing violence. We would have to get a good idea of what Mexico's actual capacity is of helping the people who are passing through Mexico en route to the United States and try to figure out if it's a real humanitarian solution or if this is just a sop to Trump's base to keep people out of the United States.
Rich, one of the sort of back channel things you hear out of this White House is essentially that Republicans in Congress should not be talking loudly about their opposition to the president's tariff strategy and in some cases their willingness to use congressional powers to block him from imposing the tariffs that he's threatened on Mexico. I mean, obviously, first, you know, the president is a protectionist and just has a favorable view toward tariffs, but also essentially saying that this is for this to be a credible threat toward Mexico in order to get concessions on immigration, they have to believe that Congress will uphold any tariffs that the president imposes. And I guess the question is, how serious are the threats from Republicans in Congress that, you know, this time they really will stand up to the president and they will use their powers to stop him from imposing the tariffs that he's threatening? And because, you know, if Mexico sees that, then they have less reason to take seriously his threats.
Right. I think the White House argument in that regard will carry the day, at least in the short term. And it's something that's also stayed some grumbling and opposition about the China tariffs as well. But again, I think if we get actually into a cycle of tariffs with Mexico, that's when the revolt becomes – the potential revolt becomes more serious. And I think you'd have a veto-proof majority potentially in the Senate. The House is another matter. You need, you know, 50 or so House Republicans. And Kevin McCarthy has made the Republican minority leader has made assurances that would never happen. He might be right about that, but again, this would be the biggest revolt against the president if it gets there. And you know, we're a little ways away, but again, we get into a thick tariff fight with Mexico, it could come.
Liz, what have you been watching?
This week, Elizabeth Warren received some words of adulation from an unlikely source, Fox host Tucker Carlson. In a Warren-oriented segment on his show, Carlson had this to say about Warrenomics.
Yesterday, Warren released what she called her plan for economic patriotism. Amazingly, that's pretty much what it is, economic patriotism. She says the U.S. government should buy American products when it can. And of course, it should. She says we need more workplace apprenticeship programs because four-year college degrees aren't right for everyone. Well, that's true. She says that taxpayers ought to benefit from the research and development that they pay for. And yet she writes, quote, we often see American companies take that research and use it to manufacture products overseas, like Apple did with the iPhone. The companies get rich and American taxpayers have subsidized the creation of low-wage foreign jobs, end quote, and so on. She sounds like Donald Trump at his best.
Needless to say, Carlson wasn't without his criticisms of Warren, but his promotion of her economic agenda certainly turned heads. There's plenty of polling that suggests there's like a vast block of voters who are essentially socially conservative but fiscally liberal. And so progressives started to worry. Could Carlson be forging a new kind of right-wing populism capable of pulling in those votes? In short, I sincerely doubt it. After all, there was another great populist hope on the right, and that was Donald Trump, just like Carlson implied. And Trump hasn't exactly been great news for the poor and downtrodden as he's moved to slash SNAP benefits and push families out of benefit programs. Even his protectionist efforts have been broadly resisted among his right cohort. We were just talking about his proposed tariffs on Mexican goods, which have received harsh criticism from the likes of Ted Cruz. In short, I don't think the donor base or political will is actually there for the right wing to really go where populism leads, which is toward programs and policies that might actually help the poor and working class without offering much of a sop to rich donors.
Rich, what do you think about that?
Well, the Tucker thing is very interesting and potentially could be an inflection point. I don't totally discount that this could be the sign of the party really beginning to go in a different direction economically. I think that would be a mistake. I think there are things that are worth thinking about in the Warren proposal. Certainly apprenticeships, reorganizing some of the bureaucracy around these various R&D programs, and basic R&D investment on the part of the government, I think is a good idea. But the more classical sort of industrial policy elements that are really oriented towards clean energy, I think, are a mistake. And basically what we should be doing is try to make more productive workers. The reason why blue-collar workers in Germany are better off or earn more than American workers is that they're more productive. And a lot of that has to do with an education system that is geared more to the needs of kids who aren't ultimately going to go on and get a master degree in English literature, who are going to in high school and have to go out and into the labor market. And we should be thinking more about those kids in this country, too.
Well, so, Rich, I guess the question is, you definitely see this impulse that people like Tucker Carlson have that basically say, you know, the old conservative consensus, the Reagan consensus on economic policy isn't serving a lot of middle-income people, and we need something that is less doctrinaire in terms of laissez-faire and letting markets decide things. But when it comes to turning that into policy, I feel like they hit a lot of stumbling blocks. I mean, for example, you hear a lot of conservatives grumbling about social media monopolies and big tech and whatever. I don't think that's translating into a coherent story about conservatives wanting tighter antitrust enforcement. I think, in fact, you know, when you see the revealed policy agenda of Republicans, it remains very skeptical of antitrust enforcement. So I guess the question is, if Warren doesn't have the right formula here and conservatives shouldn't be adopting that, what is there to do that's more than, I mean, you can talk about apprenticeships, but it actually starts feeling like the Obama economic policy, where you had a lot of, you know, small bore things trying to make modest changes to the labor market. And I think people look at that and say, these, you know, some of these are nice ideas, but they're not going to make big differences at the margin. So what is there that could be transformative and also sensible in this Tucker vein for conservatives?
Well, I think you make a good point in that the thinking that I'm more inclined to support in this area is small bore. And that's one reason why this kind of the reformicons who were focused on this issue even prior to the arrival of Trump, didn't really catch on because it wasn't anything big. There wasn't anything, as you put it, transformative. And Trump did have big and transformative, at least themes, but not policies. So this is circling back to Liz's skepticism on this because of where the Republican donor base is. I think that's part of the reason Trump hasn't followed through on his populism more, but not the entirety of the reason. I think, and this has been a theme, I'm sorry to be a bore on this, but it's just that it hasn't been thought through. And all the traditional stuff had been thought through. It was off the shelf. It was the coalition for it was there. The policy was there. Is very easy to do, and what this new agenda is hasn't been thought through, or would be hasn't been thought through, and it's certainly not going to be exactly what Elizabeth Warren favors. And they're just these Buy American plans. They sound great, but I mean, one of the reasons we have a rail system that is expensive and inefficient is we buy our own stuff, which isn't as good as stuff that's made overseas. So again, the productivity of our economy and the productivity of our workers is the thing to focus on rather than a simplistic focus on the trade deficit or imports or exports.
Liz, one thing you were saying before the show is that there's something inherently to the left about the energy that surrounds populism in politics, or that the left just ends up being better at populism, essentially. When you look around the world, I mean, when you look in Europe, it looks to me like the more successful populist political movements right now are tending to have a rightward energy. I mean, you see in Italy, you had parties that came up from the right and the left, but it really seems to be the right populists who are driving the bus there. You look at Greece, where left populists came to power, but they're likely to be swept out by an establishment conservative party soon. So I guess, what does a left populist model look like where that turns into something that's concrete policy that gets sustainably implemented?
Well, I think a left populist model thinks about workers and it thinks about workers' needs and it puts organizing at the heart of that story. So the right of workers to organize and to advocate for their own interests and to build sort of sectorial protections for themselves is a big part of populism on the left and populism in Europe. I think that the problem that you see, I mean, obviously there are several problems with right populism that you see in Europe coming up right now. One of them is that it's always and necessarily an incomplete populism. It's a populism that's aimed at protecting the rights and interests of a certain group of workers or a certain working class while excluding the rest, usually a racial other. So it's an incomplete and it's a broken populism. And because of that, it's a very fragile populism. But the left populism in the United States would aim to take workers, working people as a whole, with all of their racial diversity and their mixture of genders and gender presentations and so on and so forth, and give them the opportunity to organize, protect their interests. And I think that the second thing that left populism does much better than right populism is it also takes seriously the lives and well-beings of non-workers. And that means children, elderly people, disabled people, caregivers, people who are outside of the labor market. So it has this two-pronged approach for sort of improving the lives of the working class because they're made up of people who work and they're made up of people who support working class families or who are parts of working class families who don't work and therefore represent a loss of economic assets, even though they're people who deserve a good quality standard of life as much as anyone.
One thing I was watching this week was the data on job creation in the United States, which was quite bad. We got a jobs report on Friday showing the U.S. economy added 75,000 non-farm jobs in May. That was 100,000 less than expected. We also got revisions of data from March and April showing those months were worse than we thought. And so an odd political fact about this moment in the Trump era is that all of this apparent unrest in American politics has been happening against the backdrop of an economy that is quite good and quite stable. Unemployment is under 4%. And so, you see this level of discontent now. Imagine what it could be like if we entered a recession. And so I don't think this is, flashing red for recession yet, but we've been having for a while this idea that, we got some worrying numbers on economic growth, but hey, at least the jobs numbers continue to look really good. This report is really saying, hey, maybe the jobs numbers are not so good as we thought. And so, Rich, I'm wondering, does the president have a plan for this besides sort of haranguing the Federal Reserve to cut interest rates and try to prop up the economy? Because I think, his whole political theory has been based on the idea that the strong economy will help him get reelected, that the strong economy also creates a buffer that creates room for him to do things like tariff fights with China and Mexico that might put a little bit of a damper on an otherwise strong economy. What is he going to do if the economy actually proves to be significantly weaker than we had thought?
Yeah, so we'll see. Maybe this is a blip, but maybe it's a sign we're misled by the earlier numbers. And yes, he will harangue the Fed, and I think he's right about the Fed. The Fed should loosen and was probably too tight last year. But he's had the one of the things motivating him to be so aggressive with China and also with Mexico threatening the tariffs is the sense that he's playing with house money. That one, he cut taxes quite substantially so he can afford to raise taxes, which what tariffs basically are in these instances. And two, he's playing from a position of strength because our economy is stronger than our trade adversaries in these instances. And if that assumption is not true, I think it throws the whole approach into doubt and reduces his leverage. And both in policy and political terms, I don't think there's a great margin for error here because you know, we've already been running quite a substantial budget deficit at a time of robust economic growth. And if we have to have even a more expansionary fiscal policy, those numbers are going to look truly disturbing. And the economy has been something that's been buttressing his political standing. So I agree, we're not looking at a recession yet, but if one were to come, that's when the politically the bottom would fall out for him likely.
Liz, this has been a messaging challenge for Democrats, I think. They have a lot of objections to the president's economic policies, but as the economic numbers have been pretty good, it's been difficult to figure out how much to talk about, you hear messaging about, well, the economy's not working for everyone, and of course that's always true, but you have a lot of voters out there who disapprove of Trump, but have so far been basically satisfied with his handling of the economy.
Right. I mean, it's been an issue for Democrats because they like to attribute, and I think everyone is guilty of this across the spectrum of politics. They like to attribute however the economy is doing to the executive who happens to be in power at the moment, when we should know very well from Obama that there are long lasting after effects in terms of determining how the economy is doing. But it has been a messaging issue. Nobody wants a recession or to see the economy falter. But if it turns out that some of these signals were actually misinterpreted, I mean, Democrats would be silly not to take advantage of that and point out that, Trumponomics, such as it is, it's not only not what it was promised, but it's not even doing what it says it was doing.
Let's take a break. I will be back with Rich Lowry of National Review and Elizabeth Brunig of The Washington Post to talk with Amanda Sloat about the president's trip to Europe. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at The Washington Post. President Trump visited Europe this week. He visited Normandy to commemorate the 75th anniversary of D-Day. He stopped off at his golf resort in Ireland. And he finally had his state visit to Great Britain with lame duck Prime Minister Theresa May, who is on her way out after failing to reach any sort of conclusion about Brexit. To discuss the visit and the outlook for Britain's relationship with both Europe and the United States, we're joined now by Amanda Sloat. Amanda is a senior fellow at the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. Hello, Amanda.
Hello.
So some of these foreign trips with Trump have led to fireworks and argument. He often doesn't get along well with the elected leaders of other democratic countries. This trip seems like it was pretty smooth in relative terms, no?
It is all becoming relative in terms of how we assess Donald Trump's trip. I think he was well behaved by his standards in terms of his formal interactions with leaders. This trip was quite high on ceremony and low on substance. However, what he was saying and doing publicly was juxtaposed with some of his more questionable decisions in terms of Twitter spats with the mayor of London, his decision to meet with some of Theresa May's political rivals, and some of the more provocative comments he made about British domestic politics in his media interviews.
What is the outlook now for Brexit with Theresa May on her way out? I mean, we will get a new Conservative prime minister. Will they do anything different in terms of resolving Britain's relationship with the European Union?
Theresa May's successor is going to face the same challenges that she did, in the sense that you have a very polarized country, you have a divided parliament, and you have European leaders that are incredibly exasperated with the state of British politics, and they have clear red lines in terms of what they're not prepared to compromise on, particularly this backstop for Northern Ireland. So the question is going to be whether the new prime minister is able to negotiate something different, which is going to be challenging, and whether or not he is able to accomplish anything different in the British Parliament to change the math in favor of support for a vote. Finally, the big debate that's happening among a lot of the contenders for Theresa May's position is whether or not they would want to take the UK out of the European Union without a deal, which a lot of analysts believe would be quite damaging to the UK in economic terms, as well as political and security repercussions.
I want to bring in Liz Brunig. Liz, we also just had an election for European Parliament in the UK, which is kind of funny because the UK is, at least in theory, supposed to be not participating in the European Parliament pretty soon. And you saw what we've seen in a number of countries, which is a real collapse in support for what had been mainstream political parties. And it kind of looks to me like a lot of that was just, you know, those two parties were unclear about where exactly they stood on the key defining issue in British politics today, that you had a couple of other parties that offered a very clear no to Brexit, and they did very well. And then you also had a party on the right wing that had a very clear, you know, yes, out under any terms. And they also did quite well. And it's been sort of strange to watch this inability of the Conservatives and Labour to form a clear position that would get clear support from the electorate.
Yeah, and I don't think it's all malicious on the part of Labour, especially to fail to form as clear of a message as possible. They're trying to respect popular sovereignty at the same time respect the principles of the party. And those things can periodically come into conflict, especially with certain motivations for support of Brexit. At the same time, I do think you're seeing a pattern worldwide of sort of collapse of support for mainstream traditional political parties and a sort of shifting to the edges as political circumstances change. And of course, that shift itself is changing political circumstances. So it didn't surprise me to see that in the UK.
Amanda, when Liz says popular sovereignty, I mean, obviously there was a referendum and Brexit won in the referendum. But you've seen, you know, all of these disputes over specific approaches to Brexit where nothing seems to have majority support. And so what is the concept within the UK about what exactly it is that the public wanted? Is there one thing that is in line with popular sovereignty?
There has been a lot of debate about that, arguments over whether or not there should be a second referendum, whether or not that is undemocratic, whether or not Parliament has had sufficient say. The problem is that we are seeing the UK become increasingly polarized, very similar to the way we are in the United States. The Brexit referendum, of course, was only won by about 2 percentage points in favor of leaving the European Union. Opinion polls now are showing that there is a slight shift in favor of remaining, partly as people are seeing the complexity of the process, they're seeing what they're going to lose in the process, but it is not a huge shift. And so some are questioning, if you had a second referendum, whether or not you would even get a significantly different result and what that would do to democracy and sovereignty arguments in the country when you had a very narrow decision going in the other direction.
Yeah, I mean, Rich, it's not just Labour that's divided internally over this. It's also the Conservatives. And one thing you hear from advocates of Brexit is that, you know, Brexit means Brexit and you have to honor the outcome of the referendum. But then I think there's a lot of other folks who say, you know, it wasn't Brexit on any terms. And it's a party where, sort of similarly to the U.S., you have a strong, you know, nationalist approach among the voters. You had strong support for Brexit among the Conservative Party electorate. But you've had a leadership in the party that has tended to be more European in orientation, tended to support remaining in the EU, at least is a lot more hesitant about the costs that might be associated with crashing out. I guess the question is there a good reason for that hesitation to say, you know, yes, I realize there was a lot of support in the party for this position, but it's going to cause so much damage and it's going to do things in a way that voters didn't necessarily understand when they voted for Brexit. Is that a reason for hesitation?
Well, I strongly supported Brexit, and I think it'd be a disaster for the Tories if they don't follow through. And I think that's one of the lessons of the EU parliamentary elections, that there should be a sorting now on both sides, where Labour is more strongly in favor of Remain and perhaps a second referendum. And I think the would-be successors to Theresa May will likely forthrightly say, look, if we don't get a deal, we're just going to go out in a new no-deal Brexit, and hope to get a better deal on that basis with that increased leverage, which would be the best outcome, but willing to go through with it if not. Now the big problem here, though, is what can you get a majority in Parliament for? And so far there's been no parliamentary majority for anything, which is the root of the problem.
Amanda, can you talk about some of those issues specific to Ireland and Northern Ireland that make Brexit complicated? Because that's also a key issue for U.S. politicians. One thing that Nancy Pelosi has laid out as Britain talks about the idea that they will seek a trade agreement with the United States once they are outside the EU is that the U.S. won't ratify anything that undermines the situation in Northern Ireland. So what are the issues with Brexit in Northern Ireland and what sort of resolution would be possible for them?
Absolutely. Northern Ireland is an issue that was not very much discussed during the referendum campaign, but it really has become the central issue in these Brexit negotiations. So right now, the United Kingdom and Ireland are both members of the European Union, which means they are both part of the single market. They are both part of the customs union system. Once the UK leaves the European Union, that border between Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK, and Ireland will become the external trading border for the European Union. And so in order to preserve the sanctity of EU regulations, they're going to want to have checks on goods that are transiting that border. Now, because of the unique history of political conflict in Northern Ireland, inserting any sort of border, especially any sort of physical infrastructure, is not only going to be practically challenging for the people that live there, but could be quite psychologically damaging. In the negotiations, the UK and the EU agreed to a backstop provision, which said that Northern Ireland, and then it was later expanded to the entire UK, would remain in some of the customs union provisions for the EU, with some additional single market provisions applying to Northern Ireland. This was objected to by some in the UK. For the Conservative Party members, especially those that were supportive of Brexit, they don't like this because it's going to limit their ability to negotiate free trade agreements with others. For the Democratic Unionist Party, which is the hardline Unionist Party propping up Theresa May's government from Northern Ireland, they don't like the idea of Northern Ireland being treated differently from the rest of the UK. So the central question for Brexit really is that the more closely aligned the UK stays to the EU in economic and regulatory terms, the less friction you're going to have on the border in Northern Ireland. The flip side of that is the less freedom you're going to have to be able to negotiate free trade agreements with countries like the United States.
Yeah. So, Rich, isn't this part of the big challenge facing conservatives that, you know, one of the things that when they have liked the EU, one of the things they've liked about it is the free trade aspect. And if you want to get those benefits, then you have to tie yourself up to EU agreements on trade. Whereas, you know, you have President Trump out there. One of the things he's excited about is the idea that he'll be able to make individual trade agreements with the UK. He's always complained that because the EU negotiates as one block, they're too difficult. Oddly, that's a well, maybe not oddly, but remarkably, that's the very similar to Vladimir Putin's concern about the European Union. So it seems like what Trump is aiming for here and what some of the nationalists are aiming for is in direct conflict with conservative principles about free trade, free movement of goods, right?
No, I think in theory, if Britain were out, it would be able to forge all sorts of free trade agreements without the restrictions of the EU that make it harder. In theory, you know, and the big prize there would be a deal with the United States. The thing is, are you going to rely on Donald Trump to actually cut that deal with you? You know, we saw how excited he was about the trade agreement with Mexico prior to potentially blowing it up with a new tariff threat. So in theory, Britain standing alone should be more of a have more opportunities to free trade than being tethered to the EU. But whether that as a practical matter, that could come to fruition is another question.
Liz, we were talking earlier about populism on the left and on the right. Is there a left alternative to the EU? I mean, Euroscepticism seems to be on the ground in Europe, very much a right-wing phenomenon. And so you end up with parties on the left sort of ending up in this box that is pro-EU. Rich was saying earlier that, you know, there should be a sorting that has the Labour Party on a more pro-EU position. But obviously, there's a lot of critiques of the EU from the left. Is there a way to advance those without ultimately advancing the interests of right-wing populists in Europe?
You'd like to see that, right? Because the critiques of the EU that come from the left, I think, are totally legitimate. And they have to do with the EU protecting capital more than labor and the free movement of capital and the mobility of capital much more than labor, which puts labor at a disadvantage. The problem is just that in this particular circumstance, any of those critiques coming out of the left are going to be sourced by a more dominant populist right in Europe in order to attack the EU for outcomes that might not actually be any better for the left at the moment. So I think it's a matter of strategically deploying those critiques in a period where circumstances don't lend them to being exploited by the right.
Amanda, how should Americans think about how the outcome of these disputes matters for the United States? I mean, obviously, we talk about what a U.S.-UK free trade agreement might look like, but I assume there are broader reasons for Americans to care whether the U.K. stays in the EU or and on what terms it might leave it.
Absolutely. I think one of the biggest challenges for the United States with these Brexit debates is that they are consuming the entire bandwidth of the British government. There was a recent report that came out by the Institute of Government in London that said 16,000 civil servants in the UK are focused on Brexit-related issues. So that means 16,000 people that could be focusing on other policy areas, including those that are of particular interest to the United States and areas where we could be cooperating. The problem is, even if they do reach a preliminary Brexit deal, it is going to take years for them to sort out the economic and security relationship between the two of them. So we really are only at the end of the beginning of this debate. The second issue relates to Northern Ireland. The United States has long been invested in the peace process in Northern Ireland. We had Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell, of course, very actively involved in negotiating the Good Friday Agreement. And so while you can argue that the debates between London and Brussels about what this looks like are a matter of domestic politics, you could also make the case that the U.S. and other countries have an interest in preserving peace and stability in Northern Ireland.
Amanda Sloat is a senior fellow at the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. Thank you for joining us, Amanda.
Thanks for having me.
Still with me are on the left, Liz Brunig of The Washington Post, and on the right, Rich Lowry of National Review. And now it's time for Tweets of the Week. Sometimes it only takes 140 characters or maybe 280 to distill the spirit of the week. Liz Brunig, what's your Tweet of the Week?
You know, with everything that Trump tweets, it's easy to miss a few real gems, and I didn't want anyone to miss this one. Trump tweeted, "Washed-up psycho Bette Midler was forced to apologize for a statement she attributed to me that turned out to be totally fabricated by her in order to make your great president look really bad. She got caught just like the fake news media gets caught. A sick scammer." Truly from one diva to another.
Rich Lowry, what tweet struck you?
My tweet is from Congresswoman Jackie Speier, who tweeted from Normandy, "Visited the grave of my friend's father and witnessed a remarkable ceremony. The letters on the white crosses almost disappear in the brightness of the stone, so a soldier fills the indentations with sand from Omaha Beach to bring the name forward. It sent shivers down my spine." And she posted a video, which I urge people to seek it out. It'll have exactly the same effect on you if you watch it.
My Tweet of the Week comes from Mark Harris, who is a critic who writes for my publication, New York Magazine, among others. He tweets, "I just saw someone say into her phone, quote, 'You're very stupid and I don't have time to argue with you,' unquote, and then hang up. I didn't even know you could call Twitter." I've been talking with Liz Brunig of The Washington Post and Rich Lowry of National Review. We will be back to talk about housing. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at The Washington Post. As you may know, Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey is running for president, and he came out this week with a big policy proposal on housing. He wants to cap people's rent at 30% of their income. Specifically, the way that would work is you would get a tax credit equal to the difference between 30% of your income and the fair market rent for a home in your area. Kamala Harris has also made a similar tax credit proposal for renters, and the proposals come at a time when housing affordability has been at the top of the agenda in many state capitals. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and Democratic legislative leaders are moving toward a significant strengthening of rent control, though details are still being hashed out. In California, the biggest focus has been on restrictive zoning by cities and counties that has held back the production of housing units. The need to loosen zoning is also an idea that shows up in Booker's proposal for federal housing policy and in a proposal from Elizabeth Warren. But are any of these ideas going to work to make housing more affordable? To discuss that, we're joined now by Michael Lenz. Michael is an associate professor of urban planning at the UCLA Luskin School of Public Affairs. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Josh.
So, Mike, one of the big concerns I hear about proposals like this from Senator Booker and Senator Harris is that if you give a big tax credit out for renters and you're giving people money and saying it has to be spent on rent, but only the same number of apartments are actually available for rent, that'll just cause rents to go up. All these housing vouchers will be out there or tax credits. They'll end up bidding up rents and it'll be landlords that actually collect the benefit from that in the form of higher rents. Is that right? And is there a way to avoid that if you're trying to give financial support to people to find housing?
Yeah, Josh, I think there is definitely some strong evidence in the housing research literature that points to the fact that you can't simply make housing vouchers more plentiful and of higher value in order to lower the cost of housing for people. But it does have some positive effects for those tenants as well. It's not a one-for-one situation in which every dollar you spend simply goes into the pockets of landlords. But there, it is what we would call a leaky bucket in that some of that subsidy is going to go to landlords. Some of the things that it's going to affect that or limit that leakiness of the bucket, if you will, is the extent to which there's more competition amongst landlords. And in places where we don't have a lot of housing opportunities, particularly for low-income households, landlords have a lot of bargaining power. They can raise rents commensurate with the increases in the subsidies. They have more power to do that. In places where there are more housing opportunities, where there's both a mix of subsidized housing production and market rate housing production, higher vacancy rates, things like that, it is less possible for a landlord to simply raise the rents to reflect the increase in subsidy. But I will also note that, we're not really in most markets anywhere near close to being too generous with voucher programs in most analyses in order to really worry too much about huge windfalls going to landlords in that kind of respect.
Liz, is the problem here thinking too much about housing as a market good? I mean, obviously, the answer to landlords will capture this that you're seeing discussed in New York's legislature is that you impose controls on rent that prevent them from raising rents in order to capture this windfall or any other windfall, the windfall that they've captured over the last few decades as New York, for example, has become a more desirable place to live and housing production hasn't caught up with it. That's ended up being higher rents. You can have a law that just says you can't charge higher rents.
Right. You could go for rent control, which I don't have any problem with, or you could go directly for supply. And so sometimes you see proposals on the left that suggest what is called social housing, which would be the government just building more housing in areas that have these severe pressures. And then when you increase the supply, the prices are going to go down. You can also just have the state act as rentier there. So you don't risk these vouchers going to private landlords, the sort of risk you were discussing. Instead, you just have an increased supply with reasonably priced rents coming directly from the government itself. And I don't think that's a bad idea either. I think it might be a more elegant solution to the issues Booker has identified.
Michael, what do you make of that, the idea of direct government provision of housing? Is there a workable model for that?
Definitely. We just, in this country, haven't really funded that over time very well, right? So our experience is largely with constructing public housing in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, and largely over time, this is a very complicated story, but largely over time neglecting those properties and making those properties the kind of last-ditch housing for the very poor and people who don't really have a lot of options. And then wrapped in that was a long history of racial segregation and various racial and spatial justice issues. Can it work? Well, in this country, we haven't really tried in a way that you would conceivably see it working. If we assume that this country is not likely to fund the public provision of housing in ways that would make it feasible and really acceptable housing options for people of various low to moderate means, then it's hard to fully get behind it. In the ideal, I'm for it. In the way that we've practiced it in this country, if you're a little bit more pessimistic, it's hard to really see that as being the likely outcome in the near term.
Rich, what do conservatives have to say in this debate? Because it feels like there's a robust conversation on the left that ranges from, you know, more government interventionist approaches all the way to, you know, have the government build and own housing, to interventions in the market to subsidize people who can't afford housing. And even the deregulatory ideas that we're hearing, you know, state and local officials really pushing for loosening of zoning, state laws that would intervene and stop municipalities from stopping the production of housing. Even most of the people producing those, you know, more market-oriented ideas tend to be Democratic officials. What is the Republican prescription for what to do about people who find housing to be too much of a burden to afford?
Well, it hasn't been high on the Republican or conservative agenda, but those people who have paid attention to it and written about it, and we've had some in the pages of National Review, are in favor of loosening zoning laws and building more housing. So basic economics here apply. The greater the supply is, the lower the cost is. But if you continue to have a limited, artificially limited supply, and you just subsidize demand, you're going to send prices even spiraling higher. And I do think this is a serious problem. It's obviously a quality of life problem. It's a pocketbook problem. But it also, to the extent it squeezes working class people out of economically dynamic urban areas and makes their commutes, you know, hellacious, or makes it impossible for them to work in these places, it is a suppressant of economic mobility. So it should be something high on the public policy agenda, but I don't see a really plausible alternative to just building more housing.
But Rich, when you say conservatives, when they think about it, they're for building more housing, what does that mean in practice? Because I feel like often the way this conversation goes is that conservatives observe, correctly in my view, that a lot of municipalities have rules that are too restrictive, that make it too difficult to add housing units. But then they're reluctant to impose restrictions from above, either, you know, state laws or federal incentives through federal grants and that sort of thing, that try to push municipalities to permit more because they have a focus on local control and they don't want to tell municipalities what they have to do, even though they have opinions about what municipalities should do. And so it seems to me that doesn't add up to an agenda that actually does anything to get more housing built.
This is a classic thing that is most appropriate to be hashed out at the local level. But at the local levels, and especially in these places with the most restricted housing and most restrictive zoning laws, they should loosen up. That's our policy to the extent we focused on it.
Mike, one of the key debates that you hear among housing advocates is if you do permit a lot more development, if you override local zoning rules and say, no, you have to permit a lot more apartments, and if that works to increase the production of homes, does that necessarily lead to more affordability? I mean, some people say it's like any other good. You make more of it and the price goes down. And then other people say, no, it's, you know, you allow more construction in areas that are already gentrifying, and that just leads to even more rapid neighborhood change that makes things more unaffordable for people. Where do you come down on that? If we build more housing, will that do a lot to make housing more affordable?
Yeah, I think the big problem that we're sitting in right now is that we have been not building in a lot of municipalities, particularly in California, that I know best, for so long that this is not a problem that lends itself to an easy fix. My standard answer or thought on this is that we need a variety of tools and a variety of interventions in order to address a multifaceted problem of housing affordability that is really a result of a pile up of bad decisions over time. I think what people think about when they think about relaxing land use regulations, they think about, okay, now you're going to allow some developer to come into my neighborhood and build a very large tower. And, you know, every time I see a large condo tower, the only people that come in and out of there are rather wealthy, and the price of those units is very high. That's not necessarily the solution or the only solution or the only type of housing that we can build or the only type of housing that we have been restricting. Right now, if the only thing that we're allowing to be built is condos and towers that are, you know, downtown that tend to be priced for very high income people, no, those benefits are not likely to accrue to the lower income households that we in housing policy circles care about. You know, so starting with thinking about how we increase the housing supply in ways that's not just targeted at the high end, I think is very important. The other piece of this is, you know, like I said, we need a variety of tools, and, you know, having more attention to tenant protections, subsidy, government or publicly subsidized housing stock, at least in part, that's going to kind of accentuate the more market-based interventions is important as well. You can't do this all by building market rate supply. You can't do this all by subsidizing out of it. You need a variety of tools.
Yeah, Liz, this is a hobby horse for Matt Iglesias at Vox, who writes a lot on housing policy, that people sort of talk about social housing as an alternative to market interventions that, you know, that try to loosen zoning and just, you know, allow the markets to allow more housing to be built. He points out that public housing is still politically regulated and subject to land use, and more broadly, subject to political objection. People who oppose a private tower built right near their home are likely to also oppose a public tower built right near their home. So I guess, how do you think about combining those two things? You know, even if you had budget for more social housing, you would still need to find a strategy to overcome very local political objections to adding any sort of building in any location.
Right. I mean, you're always going to have this sort of NIMBY objections to more housing being built. And so there's a political aspect to overcoming that, which has to do with familiarizing communities with the reasons that we're trying to build more housing, that there is a serious supply issue that's causing an enormous burden on lots of people who are not just the undesirables or unfit, they imagine, coming into their communities, but ordinary working people who just cannot meet the burden of housing costs, especially in these very expensive metro areas. And then I think there is an aspect of it that has to do with just sort of trying to push past, in whatever legislatively available ways you can, those objections that come from a place of not really even being particularly interested in understanding the burden this places on working class communities.
Rich, I see certain parallels here to markets in healthcare and education, where you've had cost increases that have outpaced inflation, and some part of that has been regulatory. But then once you have those, then you get more pressure from more government interventions because people find that the price increases are unsustainable for them, and they need assistance paying for things. So I guess, do you worry that if there isn't enough intervention in the market to try to deliver as many housing units as are demanded, that you're going to get things like you're seeing in New York, where basically people say these rents are out of control, we need another round of rent control measures?
Yeah, that's one worry. But I think the citing the examples of education and healthcare is very apt, because I think it's the same problem, the kind of limits on supply and a lot of subsidy for demand. And it's a short-circuiting of the market rather than a market excess. And in New York, the problem is if you go too far down the road of rent control, you begin to discourage landlords from investing and improving in their housing stock. So you get declining quality of housing. And I have to say, I'm not sympathetic at all. You know, as a policy matter, I think the NIMBY people are wrong. And I also just, I'm a density guy. I'm an urban guy. I love high rises. I love lots of people packed into one area. I think it creates more vibrant and interesting lifestyle. It creates more walkable rather than kind of car-based everyday living. But I the vast majority of Americans, unfortunately, do not agree with me.
Michael, just one quick question before we go. I want to get you in on what Rich said there about rent control and discouraging investment in existing apartment buildings. How much is that something that should be worried about? What's the evidence on how rent control affects the housing market? Should we worry that it has negative unintended consequences, or is it an effective policy to transfer rental income effectively away from landlords toward tenants?
Well, it definitely depends on how you design a rent control regulation. If you build in different incentives and different pieces of legislation to allow for increases when there are improvements to the property, that will certainly lessen the extent to which we have this disinvestment problem when we cap rents. That, you know, can also come with its own downsides or unintended consequences, where then a landlord will, in some cases, improve the property in order to price people out that are currently sitting in that unit. So it's definitely hard to perfectly align the policy with the outcomes that you want in rent control. And it's difficult to game plan for all of the funky choices that people are going to make, both on the landlord and tenant side, as a result.
Michael Lenz is an associate professor of urban planning at the UCLA Luskin School of Public Affairs. Mike, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Josh.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Liz Brunig, what's your rant?
It's summertime now, which means I'm out pushing my kid around in a stroller a lot, and it also means there are a lot of people riding those little rent-a-scooter things everywhere. The problem is there needs to be some kind of agreement between the stroller community and the scooter community as to where you put the scooter when you're done with it. There are tons of these immobile scooters in the middle of sidewalks that make it nigh impossible to get your stroller around the city. People, I'm begging you, put it by a tree or something.
Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
Joe Biden provided a masterclass in craven inconsistency over the last few days. At first, he said he opposed the Hyde Amendment, a traditional bipartisan measure that forbids federal funding of abortion. Then he said he supported it in keeping with his long-held view. After a firestorm on the left, though, he came out in opposition yet again. And this is supposed to be the moderate elder statesman in the Democratic field.
For my rant, I just want to remind people that the message of The Great Gatsby is not that it's fun to be rich and throw fancy parties. The Wall Street Journal reports on the glut of speculatively built mega mansions in the hills above Los Angeles. There are about 50 new homes available at prices over $20 million, and it turns out there aren't enough super rich people who are interested in buying them, so the builders are having to cut their prices and resort to ridiculous marketing tactics. In the case of one Bel Air mansion listed at $35.5 million, that tactic was a Gatsby-themed open house where potential buyers could imagine themselves hosting parties like Jay Gatsby did, I guess. Now, remember, The Great Gatsby is a book about the fundamental emptiness of ostentatious wealth. Spoiler alert, Jay Gatsby ends up dead at the end of the book and almost nobody shows up to his funeral. So maybe come up with another pitch for your super expensive house? That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Liz Brunig, Amanda Sloat, and Michael Lenz. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.